One year ago today, Orlando saw the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Just ahead, we mark the grim anniversary of the tragedy at the Pulse nightclub. Good Monday morning. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime or on iTunes. We are also streaming this show live right now on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. And just ahead, we remember the terrorist attack at the Pulse Club in Orlando. You can get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, why June is Elder Abuse Awareness Month, plus Culpepper on the Jags mini camp and some other sports news and notes. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, church bells throughout Orlando will ring 49 times today at noon, 1 year after the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Governor Rick Scott has also ordered all U.S. flags around the state to fly at half-staff today to commemorate the deaths of 49 people who were gunned down last June 12th at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. The shooter, Omar Mateen, burst into the club's Latin night at just after 2 a.m. last year, pledged allegiance to the Islamic State during the attack, and he was eventually killed by police during a shootout after a three-hour standoff. His wife, Noor Salman, is facing charges of aiding and abetting and obstruction in federal court. She has pleaded not guilty to helping her husband carry out the attack. Now, services and memorials were scheduled in Central Florida, around the country, and here in Jacksonville to try to turn this grim anniversary into something positive and honor those who lost their lives. We begin the hour this Monday marking the tragic Pulse anniversary as we welcome two guests with perspective. Brendan Byrne is a reporter for WMFE in Orlando. He covered the shootings last year and joins us by phone from Central Florida. Brendan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And also on the line here in Jacksonville, Caitlin Legg, director of the UNF LGBT Resource Center. Caitlin, thanks for joining the show as well.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having us.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about the one-year anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shootings in Orlando, the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history? It's 549-2937 to join us, 549-2937, or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or you can weigh in on Facebook. Brendan, let's begin with you. Church bells will ring out today in Orlando, and a number of services and memorials scheduled as well. Can you set the scene for us, everything that's happening down there in the City Beautiful today?
Well, it's almost countless at this point. It's tough to even get a handle on everything that's actually happening today. This morning at 1 a.m. or earlier this morning, about 1 a.m., they had a vigil at the Pulse nightclub. The angels came out. Those are the angel wings that protected the funerals in the wake of the shooting last year came out. There's just been a lot of reflection, a lot of looking back, and it's really a day of remembrance here in Orlando.
City officials have also called Monday in Orlando a day of love and kindness. They're encouraging people to volunteer or perform acts of compassion. That's something that's happening as well, correct?
That is correct, and it kind of echoes what happened a year ago today when the news of the shooting happened, and there were folks that were lining out at blood banks to donate blood and to give water and to help out. So it's nice to see that happening again and see that, you know, over the past year, this city really has embraced love, and it's great to see everyone come together. And you speak to some of the people, we're not a handshaking town anymore, we're a hugging town.
And it's 549-2937 to join us. Caitlin Legg, your director of UNF's LGBT Resource Center. There was a memorial in Jacksonville yesterday to mark the Pulse tragedy as well. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, definitely. So many of our local organizations who worked on the HRO and who are really connected with LGBT equality came together over a conference call several weeks ago to talk about how we can honor the individuals who are impacted as well as help people find ways to move forward. And so yesterday in Memorial Park, over 20 community organizations coordinated a remembrance event, and it had several components: remembering, reflecting, and responding. Because some individuals we know find comfort in remembering and honoring those who were killed, as well as the survivors, and others find healing by identifying ways to take action. And so it began with a reading of the names and a tolling of a bell 49 times to really just reflect on those individuals. And also a fact was shared that the time it takes to actually ring that bell and read the names was longer than the amount of time the gunmen took to take those lives, which is really chilling. And then speakers shared personal stories about the impact of the tragedy on their friends and families, including a young Puerto Rican trans person who shared their perspective on growing up as a Latinx person and how this event impacted their life. So it was really meant to be personal and to honor the lives of those individuals, as well as the joys and the challenges that they faced. And then today at UNF, we'll be hosting a discussion facilitated with Equality Florida to provide students and some of our employees an opportunity to participate in that same kind of event. And our young people are really growing up in a time where we've seen a huge increase in visibility of LGBT people and support from corporate companies, but yet an increase in hate crimes and anti-LGBT legislation. So we hope to help them feel empowered and supported.
It's 549-2937 to join us. And Caitlin, your comments just now wrapped up all of the intersecting issues around this tragedy. The drive toward full LGBTQ equality and acceptance. Also the intersectionality of the fact that this was a group of mostly Latino people. It was Latin night at this club that were gunned down, and all of the issues in that community, becoming transplants here in America. The divisive issue of gun violence in this country and how and whether we should regulate these types of weapons that are used to carry out these mass shootings. And then also how this nation deals with the issue of radical Islamic or Islamist terrorism. All of these issues wrapped up into one horrific event.
Mm-hmm. There's so many layers, and really taking the time to piece through all that and understand how all of these different issues around our culture and public policy and legislation are coming together. And it's easy to turn them into really oversimplified talking points, when in a reality, we need to be facilitating these conversations to think about how all these larger issues are impacting our communities.
And Brendan Byrne with WMFE in Orlando, you covered the shootings a year ago. You've seen how this tragedy has impacted Orlando in so many ways. For example, NPR reporting that some of the police officers that responded to Pulse have been diagnosed with PTSD. Some haven't worked since the event. It was so traumatic. That's just one example of so many we could point to that I think you know quite more about, a lot more about than we do, of how this has changed Orlando, the psychic makeup of Orlando.
Yeah, it has. Our health reporter, Abe Abaraya, did a lot of reporting on the PTSD issue here. But I mean, you got to think that there's so many people that were at that club that night. You know, there was about 300 people in total that were there. All of them are dealing with the tragedy of that night, and things trigger them. And then there's also the people that knew somebody who was there, and it kind of extrapolates farther and farther out that, you know, there's 49 were killed and over 50 injured, but a lot of the community here was injured as well. And there's been a big push to get them mental health treatment and have therapy and have people that they can talk to. It's been really difficult. And with something like, you know, a so-called anniversary, you know, everyone seems to be looking back, whereas the community here is trying to look forward and trying to move forward and trying to move on and take this tragedy and make something happen. We've become a community. They're reaching out for some of these issues that your guest spoke about. So the community is moving forward.
And we'll go to your calls in a moment as we take a look back and a look forward. Today marks the one-year anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shootings in Orlando, the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history. 549-2937 to join us with your thoughts. And you mentioned how the city is moving forward. Isn't one of the ways that's happening is the owner of the Pulse nightclub, she had dedicated it in memory to her brother who she had lost to HIV. Is the nightclub going to be turned into some sort of museum or memorial? Is that in the works?
That is the plan. Orlando or the Orange County Historical Center has collected all of the pieces of memorials, mementos that were left at the scene and also left in our downtown area, and they are archiving those and keeping those together. But the owner of Pulse, Barbara Poma, has expressed that she does want to turn that into a memorial or a museum. She's looking to others like the 9/11 Memorial in New York City. And she's kind of established a group or a conference of folks to help advise her on that. But that's what she wants to do. That place will be a place of remembrance for the family to go to and for the community to turn to as a way to look back and see, just to remember those folks that were lost and injured that night.
And Larry writes on our Facebook page, "I'm remembering the outpouring of love and humanity we saw in the face of such tragedy. I'm also remembering the lives of the victims, beautiful souls lost to hate but now remembered with eternal love." And Caitlin Legg with UNF's LGBT Resource Center, here's a tweet for you from a listener. "It seems like we are no further along regarding equality, guns, mental health care in this country. Are there any signs of positive progress?" What are your thoughts about that?
You know what? I think that is such a valid feeling, too, because as we're seeing more news coverage about these issues, it can feel so overwhelming. But, you know, I am hopeful to say that I can see a lot of movement in our communities around advocacy and organizing for access to mental health care. It's something that we're working on at UNF. I know our students and our student government are advocating in Tallahassee for more funding for those resources. We're seeing organizations in the community like Jasmine expanding their services. And I think that moving forward, it's going to continue being a struggle, and we're going to continue hearing these really negative stories in the news. But, you know, Jacksonville passed the Human Rights Ordinance in February on Valentine's Day, and that was a long struggle, very long struggle. So I think if we keep doing this work and staying engaged, we can see forward movement.
Here's another comment for you, Caitlin, on our Facebook page. "One of the facts that got lost in the Pulse shooting and the rush to label it as terrorism was that the shooter, Omar Mateen, had frequented the club and had been cruising same-sex dating apps. During his call, he pledged allegiance to multiple terrorist groups who are in conflict with each other. The deeper story to this tragedy is more likely that this was someone who could not accept their own sexuality and lashed out in a horrible way." No proof of that, but that certainly has been an undercurrent discussed in the wake of this tragedy. What are your thoughts about that feedback?
Yes, I've heard that reported as well, and we've talked about it a lot just in my own personal conversations. I think the scary power of internalized homophobia and how that can turn into violence it's shocking, and it's something that we're not talking about as frequently. And so, if, you know, moving forward, finding opportunities to help support people who are LGBT and are going through that process themselves, finding opportunities to positively represent LGBT people in the media, building relationships with faith communities so that early on LGBT people and their allies are affirmed, I think that those are all ways that we can work towards ending that internalized homophobia that can turn into violence.
And Brendan Byrne with WMFE in Orlando, part of the many reasons I think that this event took such a toll in Orlando is that it's well known as a very accepting place for the LGBT community around the state. It's a magnet for young LGBT people, right?
Yeah, that's correct. We have domestic partner registry, very LGBT friendly here, and you know that's why there's quite a few clubs that are for that community here in Orlando.
And also, we haven't really explored this as much when we talk about this, but this was Latin night at the club. Most of the young people that were killed were either Puerto Rican or Latino. This was a special night, inside a special night. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So this was Latin night. So this was, you know, geared toward the Latin community. Latin night has moved on. They've taken residence at other LGBT clubs here in Orlando, and they're going strong. But I think it's really important that it was the Latino community that was affected by this tragedy. And it was something that opened our eyes up here at WMFV as to how you cover something like that and what challenges that they go through during a tragedy. So we actually explored that issue with one of our podcasts that we did here, all in Spanish. And it looks at the fact that there was a lack of translating services at Orlando Regional Medical Center. It looks at some of the how the LGBT community collides with the religious community of Latins. So it was very interesting for us to take a look at that and see the challenges within the Latino community.
Caitlin Legg, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, just to echo that, something that I was talking about yesterday with some young people was that many of these individuals at the nightclub that night who were killed weren't out to all of their family. And so that created a whole nother level of challenges for families who maybe had never thought of their young person as being LGBT. And so if we can move forward, think about how being LGBT is different within different subpopulations, and how we can help build relationships with families, I think that's really important.
Now, Brendan, you mentioned how Orlando's trying to move forward. In addition to the plans for the memorial and the museum, what are some other tentacles to this that you're still continuing to cover down there?
Well, I mean, there's still an ongoing investigation. So my reporting has been based on, I've been doing a lot of digging into the timeline of what happened that night and the investigation that is still ongoing. So that's what my focus is on. There is an investigation that was wrapped up by the FDLE that is now with our state attorney's office, and the FBI is completing a ballistics investigation as well. So we've been looking into that, waiting to see what comes of that. And also the trial of the gunman's wife will be happening. I believe jury selection is in March of next year. So those are things that I'm continuing to focus on here. Moving forward, we're just looking at how the community is dealing with this. And, you know, we've had some public events here at the station really talking to some of these people. And to echo what Caitlin was saying, you know, a lot of the people that we talked to for our reporting and our podcast that we released, they were inspired to come out because of this event. A lot of the Latino community came out because of this.
And what's the name of the podcast so people can access it?
It's Orlando 1 Year Later.
Okay. And what about Mateen's wife? You mentioned she will face charges. What's the evidence against her in terms of whether she aided and abetted Mateen?
Well, prosecutors are alleging that she was with Mateen as he cased out other locations. So he was looking at a shopping area in South Florida, and also Disney Springs. Your listeners might know it as Downtown Disney. They just changed the name of that. She's pled not guilty to that. And her attorney said that, you know, she didn't know the extent of her husband's actions, has no ties to terrorist organizations, but a federal judge did deny her bond. So she is in custody until that trial in March.
And Caitlin Legg, if you could, again, let our listeners know what's going to be happening on the UNF campus today to mark this anniversary.
Yeah, so actually our friends from Action News Jacksonville are going to be on campus handing out rainbow ribbons from the Orlando Ribbon Project from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. as a way for individuals to show their support of the LGBT community. At noon, we will be hosting a facilitated discussion with an Equality Florida staff person, again, just to provide our UNF community an opportunity to remember, reflect, and respond as well.
Well, we thank you both so much for joining us on this somber anniversary. Thanks for your thoughts and your perspectives.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. Brendan Byrne, a reporter and producer for WMFE in Orlando, and Caitlin Legg, director of UNF's LGBT Resource Center, both on the line for us this morning. And much more still ahead later, Cole Pepper on Jags mini camp and more sports news and notes. But up next, what you need to know to be prepared for hurricane season. We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Brookdale Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, presents their summer special events June 13th and June 27th, both at 2 p.m. View recently renovated select apartments. Open to the public. More information at 807-6190. Brookdale.com.
Robert Kirstein is author of the award-winning book Key West on the Edge, Inventing the Conch Republic. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Robert Kirstein. We'll discuss a firsthand account of the 1840 attack on Indian Key and talk about Norman Studios, early producers of African-American films in Jacksonville. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT's Great Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at a fraction of their value, at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. The bidding begins June 15th and continues through June 26th. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon, the best in classic and modern blues, as part of WJCT's After Hours, tonight at 11 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, hurricane season is officially underway this month, with 11 to 17 named storms expected this year. And preparation is key for weathering those storms in Florida. In the event of a hurricane, there's always that mad dash for water, food, batteries, gas, generators, plywood. But preparation around your personal finances can often be overlooked in all that hustle and bustle. That's a shame, because your financial plan for a big storm should work in tandem with your emergency plan. Here now with some good and timely advice, we welcome Jerry Section, President and CEO of Jack's Federal Credit Union. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
And I didn't even think of this. You know, you just think about, oh, do I have water? Do I have batteries? Do I have cash?
That's very common.
That's part of the financial plan. But there's a lot more to think about, and you've got some good information here.
Right. I think one of the places you want to start is taking a look at what you've done to your home recently and making sure that your homeowner's insurance is up to date. If you've added, say, a pool or done some updates to your kitchen or bathrooms, please let your homeowner's insurance know so you can get the right value on your property.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah, I don't think people even think of that most of the time.
You don't. And then I think while we're talking about insurance, you want to make sure you have all your important documents at hand. Make sure you have the birth certificates, marriage certificates, the deed to the home, a copy of your homeowner's insurance, and you want to put that in a safe place. Jack's Federal and many of the banks in town, credit unions in town, have safe deposit boxes. You might want to consider that.
Mm-hmm.
But you also want to keep a copy of your insurance policy with you if you should decide to evacuate.
Right. And in the rush to leave, if you have to evacuate, people probably don't usually think of that.
Right. Another thing you want to do if you decide to leave is, or even if you don't decide to leave, make sure that you take a picture, even with your smartphone, of all your rooms of your house, because you probably bought a new computer or some furniture, and you want to make sure that's, if you have to file a claim, you've got all that, you've got a picture of it.
If you don't have photos, is it just impossible to prove that, look, I need to claim that my
losses? No, I don't think it's impossible to prove, but it just makes it much easier for you to remember what's really in the house. If you have the receipts, that's even better. But The photos are more so to just kind of spur the memory so that you know what you have to claim.
Now, you mentioned keeping all your important documents somewhere off-site, because if you lose everything, those documents could be literally gone with the wind.
Mm-hmm.
I have a bunch of documents in what I call a burn box. You know, it's
good
this
idea.
Fireproof locked box in my closet. Now I'm rethinking that. Maybe I need to make copies and put them in a safe deposit box, too.
It might not be a bad idea. That way you know you'll have them handy. They'll be off-site.
Yeah.
Yes.
And have you had people come to you saying, I've lost everything? You know, I don't even know where to begin to piece it all together.
Not from hurricanes here. We have had a few members who've lost everything through a fire. And that's when you're trying to help them piece things together through statements and things that they've purchased. And there's no way, really, to replace some of the things like family photos and stuff.
Sure. Now, here's another one that you say is so important. Set up automatic payments.
Yes, people don't really think about it. If you have to leave town, you're not going to have the mail necessarily to remind you to pay your JEA bill or your FPL bill or the water bill. And those can all be set up on automatic payments. And maybe you only set them up during the hurricane season if you don't want to do it on a permanent basis. But at least you'll know that those things are going to get taken care of. You want to make sure that you have your credit card and debit cards with you. But it's also good to write down the phone numbers, maybe put them in your phone. Because just let's say you have a question and you can't, you're not going to be 100% with your, you know, not together at that time. And if you have a question, you'll know how to reach your financial institutions.
Okay. And last but not least, I think most people do this, but it can't be stressed enough. If the grid goes down and nothing's open, you got to have a lot of cash on hand.
Yes. And that can kind of be a double-edged sword. You want to have enough, but you don't want to have too much as you become a target. So you might want to think of where can I get my hands on cash? So you want to have a debit card, credit card, and you want to know where the surcharge-free ATMs are. And if you are away from Jacksonville, many of the credit unions in Jacksonville are part of a shared branching network, so you can access your credit union from a number of cities in the country.
I didn't know that. So does it matter which credit union? If you see a sign that says credit union, is there a good chance it'll be linked?
No, not all of them. What you want to look for is a shared branching credit union. And call your credit union and see if they're a member. Jax Federal is.
All right. She's Jerry Section, President and CEO of Jax Federal Credit Union. Good advice. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
We'll be right back.
Next time on 1A, the gun debate, 1 year after the Pulse nightclub shooting. It was America's deadliest terror attack since 9/11. Some in the LGBT community began raising money to take on the NRA. As the country marks this anniversary, how well are we protecting this community from gun violence? Or should LGBT people take their safety into their own hands? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Tourism wasn't much of a campaign issue last year, but campaign promises do have a way of trickling down.
That will inevitably have some sort of impact on the tourism that happens here.
I'm Kai Rizdal, sightseeing in Erie. Also the numbers from Wall Street and the rest of the day's business news. That is next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
How is Jacksonville spending our tax money? For years, city leaders have talked about bringing jobs and updating infrastructure to make the city more attractive. But are those investments spread across the city equally? Join our panel of experts and moderator Melissa Ross for a live, interactive, televised discussion on June 29th. To send your questions or to RSVP, go to wjct.org/events.
In the woods of northern Minnesota, there's a magical place, a land where humans and bears are friends.
I could lay down and the cubs would climb over me.
But to some residents, that reality is a nightmare.
People have trained them to come up to a body and make contact. I'm not okay with that.
This week, Invisibilia explores what happens when two realities collide.
Sundays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's an important issue related to our aging population. Virtually all countries around the world are expected to see a big growth in the number of older persons over the next decade. And because the numbers of seniors are growing, the amount of elder abuse can be expected to rise as well. This has been a taboo topic, but it started to gain more visibility. The problem, though, is it remains one of the least investigated types of violence in national surveys. Elder abuse, a big issue around the country and especially here in Florida with our large senior population. Now, June is Elder Abuse Awareness and Prevention Month. And this Thursday, June 15th, has been designated World Elder Abuse Awareness Day by the United Nations. There's a lot happening around town to raise awareness about this. Here with more, we welcome Linda Levin, Executive Director of ElderSource. Heidi Katz is here as well. She's Director of Business Innovation and Development there. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And so this Thursday, Linda, World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, you're going to mark the occasion at the Downtown Library, a big free event. What's going to be happening?
So the first 75 people from the community who come will be able to enjoy a lunch, which is always very nice. But the event is very important. There will be speakers that include Ken Amaro from First Coast News, Lynn Powell from the Department of Children and Families, and Tance Roberts, an attorney at Matanzas Law Group. And they're going to be talking about elder abuse, what is it, what to look for, and how to, for you, yourself, not to be a victim.
And this is a big issue, Heidi. Can you tell us a little bit about the situation you see here in Northeast Florida and around the state?
Absolutely. Well, according to the Administration for Community Living, approximately 5 million older Americans are abused, neglected, or exploited each year, keeping in mind those are reported cases. In Northeast Florida, there were 2,000 reports of adult abuse involving someone aged 60 or older in 2016. And as I said before, that's just reported cases because we know that many instances do go unreported.
And what are the signs people should be looking out for if they suspect a senior is in this situation? It can be subtle, right?
Well, it's important to recognize that there are different types of abuse. We are all familiar with physical abuse, where the signs are fairly evident: bruising, broken bones, anything that you can see on the body. But there are different types of neglect. There's financial abuse, which is a problem. There's neglect abuse. There's also self-abuse in the older adult community. Mm-hmm. And what we want to get out to the community, and we do this in the form of a training and a form of events that we have going on this week, is how to recognize the different symptoms around the types of abuse, the where, the when, the who, understanding who tends to be the perpetrators of these types of abuse, and then understanding that we're all mandatory reporters, what that means, where to report, how to appropriately handle a situation, and what your rights are as a reporter as well.
Linda Levin, people need information on that. They don't know who to call or what to do if they suspect something's not right.
Right. Anytime someone has any suspicion of adult abuse, neglect, exploitation, they should call the Department of Children and Families. It's an 800 number, 1-800-96-ABUSE. And those calls could be anonymous. And all they need is a suspicion. They don't need to know for a fact. They're not the investigator. The Department of Children and Families does that work.
I think a lot of adults have internalized this idea that we're all reporters if we suspect something is being done to harm a child, but not necessarily an older person. This is still not as aware. We're not as aware, I think, as we need to be. That's why this month of awareness seems to be so important. This is a vulnerable population.
Very vulnerable, especially frail older adults. Many of the abusers are people they know, family, friends, neighbors. And so it is underreported. They're embarrassed. They're humiliated by being a victim. And we need to help them. And we need to look out as neighbors and community members.
Even I remember reading about this recently. Mickey Rooney, before he passed, it came out that he was the victim of elder abuse. He was being terribly abused by the people that were taking care of him. It can happen to any senior citizen, right?
It can happen to any senior citizen. It doesn't matter race, religion, income. It's anybody. And again, it's a matter of everyone paying attention and speaking up.
Now, in addition to the event on the 15th, you have training that you're offering. This is really low-cost training, Heidi. Can you tell us about this?
Yes, absolutely. So at ElderSource Institute, we offer trainings to give information out to the community. And in recognition of June being Elder Abuse Awareness Month, we are doing an Elder Abuse Awareness and Prevention training at ElderSource on June 21st from 12 to 1:30. The cost is $10 per person to participate, and we do offer CEUs for those that come. And this training is an interactive and comprehensive training for community members, healthcare professionals, and others who interact and work with older adults. The goal, to raise awareness about the types of abuse, risk factors, indicators of abuse, as well as the appropriate reporting.
June is Elder Abuse Awareness Month. It's 549-2937 to join us. Jason is on the north side. Hi, Jason. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love the show.
Thanks.
Really appreciate you guys talking about this. I just want to share an experience I had. My grandparents raised me, and my great-grandparents actually moved in with us when I was about 10 years old. And my great-grandfather, suffering from several medical issues, he was in his 90s, and was placed in a home in Jacksonville. And I can remember going there with my grandfather and just the smell of the place and the dim lights and the people crying. And I remember this man in the hallway, just tears rolling down his face, saying, please get me out of here. And as we went into the room, my grandfather was there, and he was dirty, my great-grandfather, and he had been bathed. And luckily, my grandfather, as his advocate, absolutely just raised Cain about the whole issue and got him out of there that night, which was not, you can't just pull someone out. But I will never, ever forget that. And it was a couple years later, I actually remember seeing that home got shut down for neglect and abuse. And I just love to hear you guys talking about it, and I would love to hear what you would have to say or your comments. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. I'm sorry to hear that. And that's a common tale that we hear, isn't it, Linda?
Sure. It's not always in the home. Sometimes it's in a facility.
In a facility.
Facilities are licensed by the Agency for Healthcare Administration. So any concerns there should be reported not just to the abuse hotline, but also to ACA. And anyone who needs that number can call our office, and we're happy to connect them.
And are you still getting a lot of reports of facilities, or is it more abuse you think that's going on in homes?
Well, we don't actually get those reports, so I don't have the data on that. Mm-hmm. The Department of Children and Families does, so I'm not sure.
I have this impression that in recent years, facilities have really cleaned up their act, that it's not as common. But, what do you think, Heidi?
I think the statistics would probably
show
best.
Otherwise.
Yes, perhaps.
Okay. And it's 549-2937. Mary on the northwest side. Go ahead, Mary.
I want to let you know that I lived in the the southern part of your town, right where it joins the next. And I was terribly beaten by the lady whom I shared the apartment with. I called the police department. The gentleman came in, and the woman had threatened to stab me with a knife. I fell to the floor. I suppose I fainted. And when the policeman got there, he questioned me. He didn't question her. So your city, unfortunately, is tragic. And when I called the proper group to get help, all they said to me and the policeman that day suggested that I move out, leaving all of my valuables behind so that she could go ahead and steal more from me. Tragically, your city I couldn't get any help from anyone. And I was badly bruised, beaten, but they seemed to be protecting her more than me. And it's a tragic, tragic city to live in. Thank you.
I'm sorry to hear that too, Mary.
So, Mary, I'm sorry to hear that as well. And it's because of situations like this and Jason's that these events are so important, the awareness of community members and also professionals. We also work with the Women's Center and other partners who are conducting trainings of law enforcement officers and first responders and people in the legal sector on this issue as well, and things that could be done better.
Now, Mary wasn't afraid to tell her story, but a minute ago you mentioned a lot of older people are embarrassed to tell authorities what's going on. Why is that?
Well, no one wants to be a victim, especially an older adult who's lived their life independently, to now be dependent on help. And again, often it's it's a family member, someone they know, or they don't want to show their family member that they can't live on their own and be independent and handle situations. So it is important for people to speak up and speak out and not be embarrassed. Also, unfortunately, some neglect situations are self-neglect, where people, again, are not taking care of themselves and doing what they need to do.
And that can be tough, too. My grandparents, before they passed away, they lived independently almost till the very end of their lives. My grandfather lived into his late 90s. My grandmother lived to be 100. But as they started to have trouble living at home, they got very testy when my mom and my aunts and uncles tried to send in help. You know, this is not exactly the same issue that you're talking about, but they didn't want help. They didn't want Meals on Wheels, and they were malnourished, but they wouldn't take the food. I mean, it was a really tough situation for the whole family. That's not uncommon either, is it?
Most definitely not uncommon.
Yeah. Okay, so let's mention again, this Thursday, the 15th, it's World Elder Abuse Awareness Day at the Main Library, a free event from 11 to 1, and free lunch, right?
For the first 75 to register.
And Heidi, can you tell us again how people can access this training?
Yes, absolutely. You can go to our website, eldersourceinstitute.org, register right online, or feel free to contact me at heidi.katz@eldersourceinstitute.org. Caller number 391-6600. We'll be happy to get you registered.
All right. It is Elder Abuse Awareness Month this month. Linda Levin is Executive Director of Elder Source Institute. Heidi Katz, Director of Business Innovation and Development. Ladies, thanks for telling us all about it.
Thank you for giving this opportunity to talk about it.
Thank you, Melissa.
We'll be right back with Culpepper.
On the next Fresh Air, Mark Bowden, author of the bestseller Black Hawk Down, has a new book about the single bloodiest battle of the Vietnam War. The 26-day struggle for the city of Hue, taken in the 1968 Tet Offensive, was marked by intense urban combat and civilian massacres.
It was ultimately the turning point for Americans in the war in Vietnam.
Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
We go to Nick and Eddie's on Sullivan Street. We go to La Dolce Vita. Every time we walked in the restaurant, the seas would part. The waiters would trip over themselves to take care of us because Anthony the Hat was there. Eddie LeBlanc was there. Frankie California was there.
Join us for True Stories in honor of the Moth's 20-year anniversary. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Save the date for Girls' Day Out, Saturday, August 26, 2017 at the Hyatt Riverfront. Join us for a day of pampering and making time to care for you. Be inspired by health experts, free screenings, and great door prizes. Keynote speaker is Jennifer Berman, MD, co-host of the Emmy Award-winning talk show, The Doctors. Go to wjct.org/girlsdayout to register.
Listen to Hotsy Totsy Sunday nights at 9, celebrating the music from the 20s and 30s, only on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world, your music.
So everything is a Hotsy Totsy now.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, the Jaguars prepare for mini camp, and we expect a new face out there on the practice field this week.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Culpepper, here now with more about the Jags offseason and the rest of your sports news and notes. Hey, Cole.
Good morning, Melissa. To this point of the offseason, the Jaguars' practices have been voluntary, at least that's the official designation. So Brandon Albert, the left tackle the Jaguars traded from Miami for, there's probably some English teachers cringing at that sentence, has been taking advantage of the voluntary nature of those practices. The 32-year-old 10-year veteran wants a new contract. and he's been skipping the offseason work with the team. But Jaguars head coach Doug Marrone said last week that Albert told him that he would be participating in this week's minicamp. The difference here is money. Under the collective bargaining agreement between the Players Association and the league, you can't be fined for skipping voluntary practices, but you can be fined for missing minicamp.
Didn't know that.
So we'll see starting tomorrow if Albert's out there on the practice field with his new team. That all being said, I thought the most significant thing that Marrone said last week came when he was asked how many passes he would want Blake Bortles to throw each game. Marrone's answer?
None. Zero. I want to go back to the old way. I want to change the game.
Change the game.
He doesn't really expect to run the ball every play. I think. But it does speak to the tenor that Marrone's trying to instill in the Jaguars. He and Tom Coughlin won a tough-minded physical approach by this team in 2017. It's very clear to me that both think that the Jaguars were soft in the past, not tough enough.
Huh.
And to excel, for instance, in the running game, you have to take pride in winning those individual battles up front, and that starts on the offensive line. It's really, though, a part of everything that you do on offense and on defense. It's an old-school mentality, to be sure, but as I sound like somebody screaming at kids to get off his lawn, like
you,
so many old school mentalities.
You would never do that.
Get off my lawn, you consarn it. So the old school mentalities tend to work, right? When you take that approach, Gus Bradley wanted to do the new thing, and maybe his approach would have worked with a more veteran team.
But with kids, young guys, you think the Tom Coughlin way is going to be more effective?
I do. And
do you think
I will say,
he's intimidating as a coach, too? They're so intimidated that they don't want to mess up? This guy has this mythical aura around him.
There's some of that. And it also has to be delivered by Doug Marrone on the practice field as well, because Coughlin's out there, but he's not running the practices. Doug Marrone is the coach with, you know, boots on the ground coach. Part of this is the setting of expectations and how you manage people. It's just a totally different approach from Gus Bradley, who wanted to take away distractions and reduce the obstacles. And there's something to be said for that. But when you have an expectation of continued excellence, high level expectation, some of the Jaguars players had that internally, just not enough of them. They've brought in some players this offseason in the last couple of years that certainly should help in that regard. Calais Campbell, the new defensive lineman, certainly has that kind of cut. Paul Posluszny, Telvin Smith, Malik Jackson, we've talked about some of these players in the past. They have to have, if you're internally motivated and you have an expectation of yourself as a professional, fine, you can work under any system. But we know that not every 23 or 24, 25-year-old has that kind of internal expectation. Most of these guys need to be coached, managed, pushed, and that's what we're seeing more of with the Jaguars this offseason. Marrone is not even calling these practices, by the way. He says they're just activities. Practice only happens
activities
when you're hitting and you have pads on at least. So
if you're not wearing pads, you're not practicing.
You're not really practicing.
Speaking of which, they are still building that facility out there on Bay Street behind the new amphitheater.
Yes.
And as I drive by every day, I see the work going forward on that.
You know, it's interesting because there were so many stories. Is the amphitheater going to be ready? Is Daly's place going to be ready to go in time for that first concert? And obviously it was. One of the things to remember about the other half of it, which is the practice field, the flex field, is that they don't have to have that finished at any particular time. There was a concert scheduled with tickets sold for Tedeschi Trucks, and they had to be ready to go. The Jaguars have practice fields right now. They've practiced on them on the other side of the stadium. Obviously, you want to get them done so you have a chance to go inside, get under, out of the heat, out of the rain when it happens.
Yeah,
probably mostly out of the rain. But there's not the same kind of deadline for that. But it does seem to be coming along. I drove by today coming over here to the studios.
It'll be kind of cool to drive by and see them doing stuff.
Yeah, you'll see them. There's a good chance that as you drive by, they'll have the, it'll be tough to see.
They'll have some barriers up. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. All right. More sports from Cole, Florida and FSU baseball.
Yeah, both had a chance to clinch spots in the College World Series yesterday. Florida will have to wait until today. Their game against Wake Forest suspended due to storms in the area. Wake leads at 5-4 in the fifth. They'll try to get it going at 1 o'clock this afternoon. Florida State won't have to wait. They clobbered Sam Houston State 19-0 after waiting out 7.5 hours of rain to get it going. It's the 22nd appearance in the College World Series for FSU in their fourth since 2000. And by the way, largest postseason margin of victory ever at Florida State for baseball, 19-0 there.
Nice. Also, Cole says it is a wild match to talk about from the Armada.
It really was. After losing to first place Miami, they bounced back with a big road win, 4-1 at Indy. It's the first time the Armada have ever won in Indianapolis. First half stoppage time, an Indy player was red carded, so the Armada had a man advantage to start the second half. But then Jacksonville goalkeeper Caleb Patterson Sewell was also red carded in the second half for playing a handball outside the penalty area. So the Armada finished playing the game 10-10. Jacksonville remains in second place with five matches remaining in the spring season. But that wasn't the only soccer over the weekend. The U.S. men's national team last night in Mexico took a point in World Cup qualifying, a 1-1 draw. The U.S. took an early lead on Michael Bradley's goal, but Mexico equalized later in the half. Good result for the U.S., who will next play a meaningful match in September against Costa Rica.
The Shrimp will be starting a five-game homestand this week. And how about this? The Sharks are about to close out an undefeated season, maybe.
They have one more game to go, and that is Saturday. They're 11-0 after beating the High Country Grizzlies 66-18. The Sharks this year have been averaging winning games by 35 points. It's been lopsided.
Man.
First year of the new National Arena League. To be fair, a lot of these teams they're playing aren't very good. That being said, to go undefeated, still something to crow about.
Pretty exciting.
And a win in their last game makes them 12-0. They already have a home game in the playoffs wrapped up. They could have home field advantage. And I would say that considering they have the number one defense in the league, number one scoring defense, and the number one offense in the league, they are the prohibitive favorites to win the first ever National Arena League Championship.
Go Sharks.
Yep, absolutely. And you mentioned the Shrimp. They're back home starting a series on Wednesday. And we should mention that a couple other things here. The Pittsburgh Penguins won the Stanley Cup Championship last night.
Oh, yeah, lots of excitement around that.
Yep,
yeah.
A 2-0 win over Nashville. It was absolutely jam-packed down on Broadway and 2nd Ave in Nashville before the game. They had a country music concert off a roof to kick it off. They were trying to hold on in Game 6, but Pittsburgh got the win. And then the NBA Finals continue tonight. Golden State, a game away from a second title in 3 years as they take on the Cleveland Cavaliers and LeBron James.
Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper for all your sports news and notes. And listen to the Sam and Cole podcast. Always a fun listen. Good to see you, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. The serene and majestic Michelle Corum runs the board during the show. And our show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on 1A, LGBT activism and gun control 1 year after the Pulse shooting. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.